part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm gonna do it part. I'm gonna do it part-time. I'm gonna do it part. I'm gonna do it part-time. Part-timefanboy.com.
Hello, David Gallagher. How are you? I am Christian Horn. Hello.
Hi, Christian. How are you today?
I'm doing okay. Thank you for agreeing to do this episode of Part-Time Fanboy. I really appreciate you coming on.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
So just so anyone who's listening, my name is Christian Horn. This is Part-Time Fanboy. I am on the line with David Gallagher, who is the writer, correct?
Yes, I'm the writer and co-creator.
Writer and co-creator of... Well, actually, the only comic that I can think whose title is inspired by a Paul Simon song. It's called The Only Living Boy. But it has nothing to do with the song, absolutely. Right?
It kind of does, but not really. I mean, so, kind of, but very loosely. It's inspired by. I used to work for the New York City Police Department.
Oh, really?
And so during the time I was working for the New York City Police Department, I was on set of the movie I Am Legend.
Oh, really?
And so, yeah. So I was like on set and they were filming my neighborhood and I was like out walking home and on my iPod. So I was thinking, I was walking to the subway stop thinking about like cool stuff. And I was thinking like, you know, it's weird. Will Smith's like this 40-year-old, like super awesome, like tough guy battling vampires. And I thought, well, you know, like that's nothing. Like he's got this lifetime of experiences. He's like total badass.
Yeah.
And what would be really interesting, what would be a real challenge is if like you were a 12-year-old kid with no experiences and no skills or abilities to fall back on. I mean, that would be like super, super badass. Like, I mean, in terms of story, because you'd have a lot more drama that would come from this need to learn skills. You'd have this ability, like, to, you know, grow. And as I was thinking about this and thinking about the story potential of, you know, a kid in this, like a 12-year-old kid in sort of this strange Wonderland, I Am Legend-like world, the Only Living Boy in New York song came onto my iPad, and in a moment of synchronicity, I was like, oh yeah, that would be a great story. And so there's a scene, I think it's in the second chorus, where it's like, I get all the news I need from my weather report, and, you know, like, I gather all the news I need on the weather report.
Yeah.
And so what I did was I took that concept to Steve Ellis, and we had made just for our own like proof of concept in 2009, we went on to make a mini comic that was the lyrics of the song, but with a boy like battling monsters in this post-apocalyptic version of New York.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of the preview, and then we changed it a little bit and modified it a bit to sort of fit the structure of what we eventually wanted to do with it. But yeah, that was fun. That was the initial concept was, it was absolutely inspired by the song.
Wow, that's great. I didn't even know that. I just figured, because when I saw your stand at New York Comic Con, that's where we kind of met for a couple of minutes and in the artist alley, I saw the title from far away. And then I saw the artwork and I was like, oh, this looks interesting. You know what I mean? And you guys had like all four issues there and I just scooped them up because I was kind of so impressed with the initial, you know, the title works for you guys, I guess I should say, you know. But yeah, no, I that's really interesting. I figured it was just like sort of like no connection to the song at all, but you're telling me that it had something to do with your inspiration.
Right. Yeah. So it's definitely, this is definitely inspired by that. So, and obviously it's totally different Now, but that's the initial genesis of it. And we were able to, as it evolved from that sort of I Am Legend boy concept to, I think, something a little bit more robust, I think something a little bit more less post-apocalyptic and more a metaphor for growing up. And that's sort of where it is now. It's sort of a metaphor of, you know, like growing up and determining the kind of person you want to be is ultimately what the, you know, we're planning on doing with the story.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I mean, I picked up all four issues, and for anyone that's listening, I mean, it's great. Like, I really loved it. I mean, one of the first things that I think I asked you when I picked it up was like, I was like, is this all ages? Because I figured it's something, you know, after I read myself, I could hand off to my daughter. And you were like, yeah, yeah, totally. And sometimes people will hand off something and say it's all ages and it's kind of not, but this definitely is, but not in a silly way or like, you know, a goofy way. It definitely has a little bit of gravitas to it as well. It reminds me a little bit of Tellus. Have you ever read Tellus from
absolutely. I mean, it's certainly, I think that there is a, the way we describe the series is it's kind of in the vein of children's literature. Yeah. So it's sort of like Jungle Book meets The Island of Dr. Moreau meets Bridge to Terabithia. Gotcha. So it's definitely like one of those coming of age sorts of stories. We call it young adult. And it's written for middle readers. If you're familiar with that, it's like perfect for 8 to 12 year olds, but it's really for everybody. And it's got that kind of weight of, it's got the kind of weight. We wanted to make sure that it had the kind of weight, that you might find in reading one of those books that you never wanted to read in elementary school and in middle school that they sort of forced you to read because you're like, oh, look, this is the story I'm reading where the dog dies, or this is the story I read where the mom dies, or you know what I mean? Like those sort of, but we didn't want it to be like that. We wanted to have that sort of weight of a coming of age story, but also with the sense of adventure that we feel is really missing from like just unbridled adventure that we felt was missing and was a part of the audience that wasn't being served.
Gotcha. And so when you came up with this idea on the set of I Am Legend, which you have like Richard Matheson and, you know, Will Smith to thank for the genesis of the idea in a way, were you into comics or
comic
book reader?
Yeah. So, you know, I read comics when I was a teenager. Uh-huh. I worked at Marvel Comics. I interned at Marvel Comics and worked on Marvel Comics on staff for 3 years.
Oh, really? Doing what?
Yeah. Was in the Marvel Digital Comics division.
Oh, okay.
So we made some of the first digital comics, Daredevil Zero, and some what they called cyber comics at the time. So I was working with Marvel when they were pioneering that stuff. In the late 90s, early 2000s. And then I did some comics for Moonstone Books based on old-time radio shows. And then eventually did High Moon, which is a werewolf western series that won a Harvey Award for DC Comics.
Oh, wow.
And then did some Marvel stuff for Dark Star and the Winter Guard, which is like the Russian version of Avengers. Steve Ellis and I, who is my partner on Lone Living Boy and High Moon, also did a Green Lantern story over the spring. So, but mostly we're known for, and we pioneered, I guess, the first digital comic that was made exclusively for the iPhone with Box 13 for Comixology 2009. So most of what I do in comics is on the digital end, with some stuff, obviously, on the print side, you know, Dark Star and the Winter Guard, the stuff we did for Green Lantern, stuff we did for Image. But really, you know, most of our stuff lives online because we believe that that creates a low barrier to entry.
Okay. And did this started off as a webcomic, correct?
It started off as a Kickstarter.
Okay.
We did it as a Kickstarter in 2011. And then in 2012, we brought it to the web. And so that was 2013, we brought it to the web. So, yeah, so that was and that was really great for us because we were able to really bring in a lot of people who had who weren't familiar with it, and we've been really able to target an audience that is sort of underserved by the comic stores, but now they're driven to buy it in the comic stores, which is amazing.
Okay. So the internet can be used as a tool. Well, actually, that's kind of what we've been seeing in the past several years, that the internet actually fosters like print sales. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got a lot of people who read it online and want to own it. And that's fantastic for us. That makes a huge difference for us. And we've definitely seen that sort of passionate really passionate drive for people who see it online, approach us at shows and say, hey, you know, like I saw this on, you know, Noise Trade, which is one of the platforms we use, or Topastic, which is one of the other platforms, or I read about this on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, you know. So we've been really, really lucky to have that sort of involved and engaged audience.
Oh, that's great. That's really smart. Was the Kickstarter for a print project or was it for a web?
Yeah, we had printed the first issue through Kickstarter. And, you know, and that was received well. But what we realized was that the audience was small. You know, like when you do the Kickstarter, like we had like 400 backers, which is awesome. But that's not really a great way to build a readership. So, you know, we obviously released the book through Comixology. And made it free for Free Comic Book Day and did a bunch of other things that helped increase our audience. But we really wanted to use the success we had had with High Moon, which is a webcomic on DC, and really go back to our web roots and my web roots from Marvel and really make something that everyone could access, no matter where you were from. You could see it and read it and, you know, engage with it.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, I mean, I was looking through, you know, I looked through every book and obviously read every issue that I purchased at New York Comic Con. And I noticed that it said, like, in the text on the inside front cover, there was something about, like, it being published quarterly. But then when I looked at the actual dates on the book, it was like, this was 2012, this was 2013. So it seems like the actual turnout of the print issues was a bit sort of like slower than what was expected, or am I right about that?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, we had run into, I mean, the goal is to always print it quarterly. In 2013, I had ruptured my spleen.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So we were delayed because I ruptured my spleen. And then this was actually book four, which just came out. I mean, all our books are also like super huge. They're not like 20 page comics. They're super robust. I think the first issue is 54 pages. Like they're all oversized.
Yeah.
In 2013, I ruptured my spleen. That took me out of the game of writing the book for a while. And then we signed a print deal for trade paperbacks. And so that deal took some time to negotiate. So for issue four, we were simultaneously putting the trade together while putting issue four together. And that slowed things down. We're only a two-man team.
Gotcha.
Yes, the goal is still quarterly. The goal is to still have issue five out, you know, by February.
Yeah.
You go in with the best of intentions, but I mean, I think that we're really happy with sort of the success. And I think we're really happy with, not just the success of the project, but also, having created a really robust, readership. And that makes me really happy.
Yeah. No, I didn't mean to say the like release dates as any kind of slam towards you or towards your team. I think, you know, quality can take time, especially if it's an indie book, you know, and it's based, like you said, like it's a two-person team. For me, it's always fascinating that, you know, so much of the fan base has gotten locked into this monthly schedule, you know, where it's like things have to come out every month. And some of the best, like indie books, at least I know, have taken, you know, several months apart or even years at a time. And the quality shows in your book. So, you know, I guess I was just kind of mentioning it as sort of a curiosity in my own head you know, because there have been a lot of indie books that I've loved, but they take a while to come out, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with it, you know, but I think that people want to understand sort of like, why did this book not come out? And it didn't come out because of rupture in my spleen. And then the other time it didn't come out on time because, you know, like, and generally we also try to plan them around conventions. So, you know, the goal is to always, like, we always try to make sure that we're releasing the show. Sometimes we'll hold back the release of a book so that we can debut it with a convention. So it's just a matter of trying to figure out, you know, ultimately what works best for us and our team. Last year we debuted issue 3 at the show, and people have been really passionate with it, and I think that they have aged, our audience has aged up as the book has aged up, and so that's made us pretty happy. But with the new publishing deal that we signed, you know, they'll be coming out a lot quicker. So so because, you know, we have like in March, the trade of the first book comes out, which is the first two issues.
And that's then through Paper Cuts?
That's through Paper Cuts, right. Yeah. And then in July, the second trade comes out. And is in, so that's issues 3 and 4. And in November, issues 5 and 6 come out. So, you know, like, they'll be more frequent.
But, oh, wow.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's what I'm saying. So, that ultimately is the thing that, you know, the deals allowed us to do. It's allowed us to change, you know, like manipulate stuff, but we've had to do some stuff behind the scenes to, you know, we've had to do a lot of stuff behind the scenes to, initially there's a slowdown, but I think that there's just, you know, with anything, there's initially that slowdown or that bottleneck, and then you get through it, you get all those projects done. So 5 and 6 are going to be out and ready, you know, on air. I think for February, we're going to start releasing the pages for those.
Oh, that's great. That's fantastic. Will you release them online first, or?
Oh, generally we try to release them. So generally we'll release them online first, and then release the issue when it's complete. Sometimes they'll go hand in hand. It really depends on, you know, what, it really depends sort of on dates. Uh-huh. We are big with dates. So like, we like to make sure that it coincides with something good, whether it's like Free Comic Book Day or whether it's, smart, you know, Hans Christian Andersen's birthday, which is International Children's Book Day. We like to coincide it with stuff that has that gets some attention, because if we bring it out then, we find the fanfare is much more robust than if we were just to launch it on a Wednesday when all these other comics come out. We generally like to do it around something where there's a lot of attention, and it ultimately helps us.
Gotcha. So we've talked a little bit about the origins of the actual book, but we didn't really get too much into the story. Do you want to sort of break down what it's about? I mean, you touched on the sort of post-apocalyptic, but that could mean anything. That could mean Mad Max. That could mean, you know, and sometimes post-apocalyptic to people might mean like overly gritty, but this book is not that. This book is definitely something unique and different. So can you just talk a little bit about the story, you know, what happens in the book, or?
Yeah, so the story is The Only Living Boy is a story, the spiel I give to people. Is The Only Living Boy is a story of a 12-year-old boy named Eric Farrell who runs away from home. It's raining and he runs under a rock in Central Park so he can just like get some sleep and rest up. He finds a teddy bear backpack. He cuddles up with it, falls asleep, wakes up in a patchwork world, an alien world that is like a bunch of other worlds all fused together. And it is a patchwork planet. It's got mermaid warriors, insect princesses, crazy monsters, a chimerical dragon named Balakar who rules over everything, and a mad scientist named Dr. Once.
Yeah, that's a great villain, by the way. I really liked Dr. Once a lot. Actually, I really, you know, as I said, loved everything about the book, the design of the book, the concepts are really fantastic. How did you decide to sort of veer into, because this is a bit more of like a fantasy world as opposed to, you know, you had said like I Am Legend, you know, which that's like zombies, vampires, and sort of thing. Was fantasy something you were into as growing up? I mean, beyond comic books, or?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say too much about this because this is so totally blows the ending.
Oh no, don't blow the ending.
So, but I'm really inspired by the Lloyd Alexander books, like Black Cauldron.
Okay.
And books like Bridge to Terabithia.
Gotcha.
So I like sort of that, you know, like the oppressive evil force looks over this stuff, and you know, I played a lot of D&D and I played a lot of like role playing games, but. There's a reason we call it the Jungle Book meets the Island of Dr. Moreau.
Uh-huh.
Like, without being like too, without digging too deep into this. I mean, yeah, there's fantasy, but there's no magic. Like, there's nothing magical about the world we're seeing. You know, so.
Oh, that's interesting. Because it seems kind of magical to me, like visually, but now that I think of it, there aren't people like casting spells or doing that sort of thing or.
Right. And that's, I mean, yeah. Without saying too much, that's sort of the deception of the book.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, you know, so, I mean, without saying too much, like that's kind of, and we'll get into it over the next couple of issues, but, you know, that's sort of the, it looks magical. It looks like a fantasy world, but is it? Like, is it really? I mean, so that's the premise of it all, is like, what is all of this stuff? And when you see people putting stuff together, yeah, I mean, they're putting together, like, they're salvaging pieces of their lives, you know? There's crazy monsters, like, totally crazy monsters. But in doing magic, in having anything magical, at least in my mind, I would need to, like, put together, like, spells and cosmologies of how the world works. And what we did here was something different that I don't really want to get into quite yet, is we did something different. And I'm really excited about where the story is going and sort of the complexities of what it means for our characters and what it means for them growing up. I think that in terms of the story, like what's important to us is telling a story that is about growing up.
Yeah.
And when you add things that complicate that, it becomes much more difficult to tell the story. I didn't want a magical system or weird stuff to overshadow the cast of characters or overshadow Eric's journey. You know, everything that's in the story, we do have some cool, crazy concepts, but I don't want any of that to overshadow, you know, the journey of this kid.
Yeah.
One of the sort of the MacGuffins, I don't want to use it necessarily that way, but one of the primary drivers of the plot is that Balakar, who's this chimerical monster, he's made of tons of parts of other things. He's like chimerical dragon thing. He wants the secret of this transhuman evolution called the Chrysalis, and only the Sictarians, which is this race of insect warriors, have it. And yeah. It allows them to, when they reach maturity, transform into anything that is like in service of their giant insect city thing. But it allows them to become crazy. Like basically it allows them to level up into the next species.
Yeah.
So he's totally down for that. And Balakar runs this organization called works with this organization called the Consortium. They're a bunch of mysteriously robed creatures, and part of the Consortium, or somebody who works with the Consortium, is Dr. Once. So you've got like basically Balakar, who's this crazy dragon thing. You've got Dr. Once, and you've got the Consortium. They all have different motives, but they're kind of like your Cobra or your Hydra or your, you know, big monolithic bad guy group. And they are after, you know, they are after the Chrysalis. They run this thing called the census, where every alien creature that is found is then forced to fight. And the losers get experimented on, and the winners get experimented on, basically. So everyone gets experimented on. It's kind of a crazy thing. And it's really emotionally and psychologically damaging. But they fight, and it's a crazy arena thing.
Yeah.
Eric, you know, escapes from the arena with his friends Morgan, who's like this crazy Myrmidonian mermaid warrior, and Thea, who is this insect princess, and they escape, and Eric frees all the other creatures, and they roam free. And that's sort of the impetus thing, is that the bad guys want the insect princess so they can evolve to the next level. They really don't like Eric because he messed up their census, and and that's sort of the gist of everything.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a fun thing to see how they, how they run, what they do, how they maneuver in this crazy world, who they evade, who they dodge, who they become friends with, who they don't become friends with, who tricks them, who doesn't, and that's the general premise of the story. We have an underground race called the Groundlings. They are like kind of crazy scavengers who build maps and make stuff. And then you've got, your sectarians who are live in a crazy floating insect hive. And you've got the Myrmidonians who live in like this underground conch shell or underwater conch shell. And, they're all raised by different people, and it's crazy.
Well, yeah, it's crazy in a good way.
It's eclectic, but I think it's a lot of fun.
No, yeah. It's definitely
so
a lot
eclectic,
of fun.
It's eclectic. It's a lot of fun. So one of the things that's really crucial to me as a comic creator is when you've got a world, you need to have people explore it. You need to have characters exploring if it's a town, walking through the town, if it's a if it's a world, going through the world, if it's a city, going through the city. Like, you just need to have characters exploring stuff. And that was really important to us, was having this sort of this world that felt lived in,
Yeah.
It felt robust and had aspects of crazy fun stuff in it. And that to me is fun. And if you've ever seen like Saturday morning cartoons from the 80s or old Jack Kirby comics, you can see that we're going for something that is, we're hoping at least, super imaginative.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely sort of a, now that you mention it, a bit of an old Dungeons and Dragons cartoon, vibe to this book, which it was a cartoon that I loved and actually showed to my daughter, and she loved for a while. The sense of adventure in a world that you definitely don't know or understand. I guess one of the things I wanted to ask you about, which I really appreciated about the book, because the book is called The Only Living Boy, but there are two really great female characters, like protagonists in the book. And that was one of the reasons why I picked up the book myself, because, as I said, I have a daughter, and I figured that this would be something that she'd be really interested in, because sometimes she will tend to tune out if there's just a male protagonist, and there's, no females, I guess it's just a thing of being a young girl. But this one has, two really great female protagonists. Can you talk a little bit about having that aspect in there? Because this could easily just have devolved, from a different writer to like, it's just a boy and he's an adventure and it's like his adventure and no one else is involved, but you have two really great female characters in there. And I'm just wondering how that sprang from your idea.
So it was always the intention to, it was always our intention to have like, it's called The Only Living Boy, but we really wanted to have some really good ballasts. We really wanted to have somebody who came to this world completely inexperienced. Like, in a way, it's called The Only Living Boy, but it's really the story of like, Morgan, who's a Myrmidonian mermaid warrior, she is like the epitome of, I think I wrote her as like a blend. I think in the notes that I originally sent to Steve, where like she's like part She-Hulk, part Han Solo.
Uh-huh.
Like we wanted her to be slightly older. We wanted her to have skills and abilities that Eric could learn from. But she's the best fighter. She's like the best fighter. She's super. And she's a little arrogant and brash and overconfident, but it works for her. She's. And then with Thea, and so she is like she is not really down with hanging out with Thea, who is the sectarian, because sectarians sometimes eat Myrmidonians.
Yeah.
So she's not really down with that.
Yeah.
But Thea is like this princess. She's this insect princess, and what happens is she's about to evolve through this chrysalis thing. She doesn't know what she's going to become, and she's really apprehensive about it. And she's super timid because she doesn't know, she doesn't want to hurt people. So she's timid, and Morgan hates her, but Thea flies, which is really great in exploring this crazy world. So begrudgingly, all three of them are like hanging out together, but they're sort of like this id ego, super ego, you know, like Morgan's pure, like, let's fight it. Let's break everything. And Thea's like, you know, like, I just want to, you know, be, you know, really law abiding and blah, blah, blah. And Eric's like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm just going to run. But they work best. They work best together when they're all integrated. And that to me is really fun, is seeing like in issue three, we have the three of them fighting together, which is a lot of fun. In issue four, we break them up, and it's nice to see sort of how they interact in different groups and in different sections. So it's really fun to see them grow. It's really fun to see them play around with each other. They really, you know, like, it's just fun. Eric is unconventional. Morgan's really disciplined, and Dia's like, you know, I'm here to help. You know, like, she's just, they're all just really great. And what, but I really like Thea and Morgan together because they are like the odd couple. They really just don't like each other. And that I mean, but they do in the, like, the buddy cop kind of way.
Yeah.
Like, it's fun because they're so polar opposites.
Yeah, you did a really good job of having them. That was one of the things that I've really loved about the book, having the characters play off of each other. They all have, like, distinct personalities or points of view, but they all can kind of come together and work together to sort of serve their common goal, which is, you know, either, like, escaping the forces that are trying to capture them or figuring out, you know, where they're going or what their futures are. I thought that you did a really good job of, like, just having them play off of each other.
Yeah, and that to me is ultimately been the best part, is that it's definitely a lot of fun to like getting them on the page together is so much fun. And especially like Morgan does some stuff in issue four that I absolutely love, and Thea's got some stuff coming up that is unbelievable, but they all have moments together where they learn from each other and they learn to adapt and grow and breathe, and that's what's really important. And that's why the book is as expansive as it is, because we really want to play with landscapes. We really want to feel like, you know, it feels like a world that's lived in. We want it to feel almost like a storybook that you could open up, you know, and as you're opening the pages, actually open up your mind to how expansive this world is.
Yeah.
Which is why we have so many double page spreads in the book, because we really want to create that sense of expansiveness, of growth.
Yeah. So how did you meet your artist co-creator? Was it working through Marvel together? Or?
No, we, in 2007, we had, so we had kind of known each other through, cause we had worked on previous stuff, not together, but with other people. So we had worked on, I was a big fan of his work, like in the early 2000s, cause he had done Crimson Dynamo for Marvel, and he had done, he was working on another project, and he was always on my radar. So he was on my radar for a while. But we had both worked for a company called Moonstone Books. He had done Werewolf the Apocalypse stuff, and I had done Vampire the Masquerade stuff. And in 2007 at New York Comic Con, we were just talking, hey, Steve, what's up? Hey, I don't know. How are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. And I had approached him and said, hey, you know, like, DC had talked to me about doing something, and because this was before they had started their webcomics line. I said, what do you think of a werewolf Western? And his eyes lit up, and he said, werewolf Western, done. And then we worked together on High Moon, and we ran that series for 3.5 years on what was DC's project imprint then, Zuda. We won Award. We had won a Harvey Award. We had gotten nominated for a bunch of other ones. So we had done that, and that's how we met. And he ended up, just by coincidence, living 2 blocks away from me. And so we worked back and forth together. I would go over to his house, he would come over to my house, and we'd just work on cool projects together for years.
Oh,
that's... And now he lives in Ithaca, but we still have a really good back and forth kind of relationship.
That's great. Well, his stuff is absolutely outstanding. I mean, it really, you know, makes the book shine. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. I looked at it and, you know, just from the outset, I was like, oh, this is special stuff. Like, this is not just like some half-assed indie book, you know, pardon my French. But how does your process work when you work together? Do you do like a full script and then he just illustrates it? Or how do you bounce like character concepts back and forth? Like, how does your partnership work?
So what happens is generally, depending when we start a new project, it's easier to talk about when we start a new project.
Gotcha.
We start a new project. I say, hey, let's start a new project. This is an idea I'm thinking about. Or he'll come to me and say, this is an idea I'm thinking about. It happens sometimes both ways.
Gotcha.
But we're like, okay, cool. Well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And so we'll talk about ideas. We'll just have a crazy brainstorming meeting. Then I will go off to my corner. I'll write down everything. And then we'll go back and we'll review each other. We'll both review it. We'll both go back and forth on it. And then I'll write the outline and then we'll review it. We'll go back and forth on it and see what happens. And then we'll do the, then Steve will do some character art. We'll go back and forth on it. And so basically that's the idea, is to just go back and forth on every stage of the game. Steve obviously does a lot more of the art. I do some cleanup here and there, but he's definitely the art guy. And then, you know, it will go together and I'll put it together. I'll do the production part of it, you know, add the lettering, all the stuff, you know, make it sure that it's really nice to go to, you know, the printer or go to Comixology or whatever. I do all that. And then, you know, we work in the marketing together, but it's really just the going back and forth and making sure that at each stage it's approved by, you know, at each stage it's approved by the level it needs to go to, and it won't go out until we approve on it.
Oh, wow. Does he color the book as well?
Yeah, he colors the book too.
Yeah. Well, everything that he does on this book, he's got a new fan, because I was just like blown away by the artwork. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. I loved the character design. I loved the flow of the pages. I loved the energy of each character on the page. I mean, the guy definitely knows what he's doing. So yeah, congratulations on finding him or working with him, because both the story and the art like just merge together into this like perfect, like, you know, comic book. Is this a finite story, or do you see it ongoing? Or
the first series is 350 pages, so okay. We're about 200 pages left to go.
Oh, okay.
I don't want to ruin the ending, but there is more story to tell.
Yeah,
without saying too much of it, you know, I just want to be, you know, I want to be mindful. I want people to enjoy what they're reading so far. But yeah, I mean, there's going to be, I think, 5 or 6 trades from Paper Cuts, which will start being released in March.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just goes from there.
Interesting. So there is an ending and planned.
There is an ending of the first series planned.
Gotcha.
But I can't say anything.
No, I wouldn't want you to spoil anything, but I know that anyone who's read the fourth issue knows that there's something occurs, and I won't say what it is, where you're very much like, wow, things have changed. Did you always have that planned, or were you, without ruining anything, were you worried about the shift in that might take? Or
no, that was always planned from the beginning. So when I wrote the series outline, I was like, this is going to happen. This is going to be a dramatic turning point at the end of issue four. It's going to be this thing. And we were like, okay, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Well, it's going to mean all of these crazy things. He was like, oh my God, his brain almost exploded. because I don't want to say too much, but I mean, obviously, kid starts, he comes to this world without his memory. So at some point, he's going to have to get his memory back. And we are exploring what that means, you know? That's super exciting for us.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it definitely, you're saying it's going to get crazier, because like the world that you've built is pretty awesome.
Issue five and six are dark.
Oh, really?
Dark. They're dark. And then it gets better. I mean, but that's every hero's journey, and like sure. every movie or TV show you read, it's like the middle of the story is always like the dark part. It's always like, yeah, oh, Luke loses his hand, you know, Darth Vader's really his dad, that kind of stuff. You know, like it's, you know, it's dark. Like sure. Empire's dark, right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not even a Star Wars fan and Empire's dark, you know, but like the hero has to have some sort of loss or some sort of something. You know, some sort of mind beveling revelation.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because I when you say dark, though, I don't want it to seem like, because there's a couple of things you've talked about. This is not like, I mean, this is an all ages book. Like, this is a book that you could hand off to a kid of a certain age, probably like 5, 6, 7, and they would be totally cool with it. Does it shift after like?
Look, Bambi is all ages.
Yeah.
But Bambi's mom still dies.
Sure. Absolutely.
You know, Old Yeller is all ages, but spoiler, I'm sorry, Old Yeller dies.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to paint the picture that, like, just because something is all ages doesn't mean that it, and we don't ever call the book all ages. Like, we call it a young adult book.
Gotcha.
Like, it's because that is that we feel is an appropriate term. It's young adult the way that Legend of Zelda or Bridge to Terabithia are young adult. You know, like, stuff happens and it gets dark. It's dark the way Thundar the Barbarian is dark, or dark the way that Adventure Time is dark.
Sure. Like,
it's not morose and it's not depressing and it's not like, oh my God, I'm never going to smile again, kind of sad. But, you know, like, so, I mean, I don't want to say it's tragic, but as with growing up, there is a sense of loss. There's a sense of bitterness. I mean, not bitterness, of nostalgia and bittersweetness, you know? Like, we want to create that sense of, like, something is, you know, like, there's just a sense of loss. Did you see the movie Inside Out?
Of course.
Okay, so, like, Up. Like, Up is a fun movie, but there's a loss in it.
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. For me, sometimes when a creator says dark, I just don't want listeners to be like, oh, this is like, you know, the darker aspects of like Batman, you know what I mean? Where you're taking like a full curve. I totally understand that what you're talking about, you know, when you say like, oh yeah, Up, like Up has you in tears in the first 5 minutes of the movie. You're basically a blubbering idiot because it's so well told. So, I mean, I totally get what you're saying as far as like, yeah, there's a darkness to it, but, you know, I just don't want there to be a misunderstanding for anyone that's not read the book that we're going into full, like, you know, Dark Knight territory. You know what I mean? So
yeah, I mean, look, he's not going to
still get fun
like full on Watchmen at 12 and grow a beard and wear a trench coat.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Yeah, yeah, that would be a severe turn in the book. But so you've got 200 pages left. You've got two trades coming out next year. Do you have any other projects? After The Only Living Boy planned, or stuff that you're working on?
Yeah, so we're doing more High Moon, so we're going to bring that back next year. We've got a new series we're working on after that, and some sort of superhero-y project that I can't actually talk about coming out in April.
Oh,
so
great.
We've got a lot of cool stuff coming out. We've got some statues for High Moon and Only Living Boy debuting next year. Which is super exciting, from Shadowbox Toys, more details about those soon. And then, it's super exciting. It's a good time. And you know, we're really thankful to be here and to keep telling the story.
Yeah, no. Well, like I've said repeatedly during this podcast, I think it's a great book. I think anyone would love it. I highly recommend it. It's definitely one of the better things that I picked up at New York Comic Con, and I'm just really glad that I stumbled across it because it was right up my alley. It's the sort of thing that I wasn't expecting to come across, and I just really loved it.
Well, great, and I'm glad to hear that. And people can read us online at olbcomic.com. They can find us on Twitter with the same handle, at olbcomic.com.
Great. Well, you know, I really appreciate you coming on to this episode, and thank you for joining us, David Gallagher. And my name is Christian Horn, and hopefully we'll be looking forward to more Only Living Boy sooner rather than later.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely in the start of 2016.
Awesome. I can't wait. And thank you for your time. And thanks to everyone out there for listening to Part-Time Fanboy. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy.
Part-time fanboy.